From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. We value you as listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Friday marks the beginning of the Baha'i Intercalary Days. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, it wasn't 5 minutes after the sudden death of Antonin Scalia was reported that the slimier corners of the internet exploded with predictable conspiracy theories. Much more concerning is the fact that the GOP frontrunner for the White House, Donald Trump, took it upon himself to repeat some of those theories, apparently assuming that the South Carolina primaries will come down to religion. Ted Cruz ratcheted up the rhetoric by saying, if we allow our leaders to be selected from non-believers, we shouldn't be surprised when our leaders don't share our values. This, even as his wife Heidi declared that her husband is running to, quote, show this country the face of the God that we serve, which is something that Christians are actually supposed to see in every face. But I suspect that's not what she meant. And Cruz's dad weighed in on the Supreme Court crisis with the ominous warning that allowing President Obama to appoint a replacement, you know, the way the Constitution says he should, would guarantee the destruction of the U.S. of A. within 30 years. So, yeah, just another week in American politics. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
The questions the church answers are questions we don't even ask anymore. The kind of Christianity I grew up with and you grew up with is not going to be adequate for your life. Mm-hmm. And I want to open the possibility that there's a new way to look at Christianity.
John Shelby Spong is a retired Episcopal bishop, a cutting-edge theologian, and a polarizing figure for many decades. Now, aged 84... he maintains a heavy travel schedule and speaking schedule and has just published his 25th book titled Biblical Literalism, A Gentile Heresy. On this week's show, I'll welcome Bishop Spong back to State of Belief.
I really wish the president would think about not nominating somebody and to just for once here put the country first.
I do not believe the president should appoint someone.
The next president needs to appoint someone with a proven conservative record, similar to Justice Scalia.
The Senate needs to stand strong and say, we're not going to give up the U.S. Supreme Court for a generation by allowing Barack Obama to make one more liberal appointee.
Giving the slogan, no justice, no peace, an entirely new meaning, the American right has literally lost no time, zero, in the aftermath of the sudden death at age 79 of Justice Antonin Scalia to rule that President Obama cannot, must not, should not even think of, is not president enough to name a replacement on the Supreme Court. Sure, everything is hyper-partisan these days, but this battle is happening at the very center of our constitutional democracy. Later in the show, I'll talk with attorney and rabbi Dr. J. Michelson, who's watching the goings-on very closely. But first,
Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia says God has been good to the U.S. because Americans honor him.
He also rejected the notion of religious neutrality, saying the Constitution does not mandate the government to favor non-religion over religion.
The 29-year tenure of Justice Antonin Scalia, at the time of his death, the longest-serving member of the Supreme Court, was marked with a remarkable shift in the justices' willingness to engage issues of religious liberty head-on. Much of the credit or blame for the way the court approached the timeless tension between secular freedoms and religious beliefs falls to Justice Scalia. The Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty has long been at the forefront of this issue And I am very pleased to be joined now by Executive Director Brent Walker. I need to tell you, Brent is a longtime friend. And Brent, we welcome you to State of Belief Radio.
Well, then, thank you.
Much has been said about Justice Scalia's devotion to constitutional originalism. How has that impacted rulings on religious liberty issues?
I think it's been damaging, to tell you the truth, Welton. Justice Scalia's thinking on the two clauses in the First Amendment that protect religious liberty, no establishment, that government can't try to help religion, free exercise, that government shouldn't try to hurt religion, he watered both of those down and pretty much deferred to the will of the majority rather than upholding the rights of the minority, as many of us think the First Amendment was intended to do. So he led the charge in the famous or infamous Native American Smith case back in 1990 that pretty much gutted the protections in the Free Exercise Clause. That used to be that government had to show a compelling interest before it would be allowed to interfere with the free exercise of religion. And under this new regime that he came up with, as long as the law is facially neutral and generally applicable, then government can pretty much do what it wishes.
I want to know practical consequences of that kind of ruling.
It means that our religious liberty is in jeopardy. Fortunately, the Congress then came and passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and other legislation. Some of the states did to restore that high level of protection. But as a matter of constitutional interpretation, he very much weakened the protections there for free exercise and for religious minorities. Mm-hmm. And the same thing for the no establishment part. I mean, he never saw an establishment case that he really liked, whether it was Ten Commandments or state-sponsored school prayer or nativity scenes or dollars for religious education. He was okay with that. He really wanted to lower the wall of separation between church and state. Yeah. So what that does, it holds up the political branches, the will of the majority, rather than protecting the rights of the minority, as is intended, I think, in our constitutional documents. I think he'll be remembered as a towering figure on the court for his intellect and his wit and his incisive, often tartly worded opinions, even beyond his overall originalism and textualism in how he approached these cases.
Yeah. Are there changes to the way the High Court approaches religious matters in general that you've seen in the past couple of decades?
I think so. We've talked a little bit about this change in the free exercise jurisprudence over the years, weakening it somewhat, although strengthening it now by statute. The same with the no establishment part. It's really gotten to the point where, you know, the court will avoid striking anything down as a violation of the establishment clause. So I think we've moved a little bit too far in that direction. But, you know, it's going to come and go. Most of our cases are 5-4 or 4-5, and now there may be 4-4, at least in the interim. But some are unanimous. The most recent cases on free exercise, the court dealing with the rights of employees to wear a hijab on the job, the rights of a Muslim prisoner to grow a half-inch beard. One was 8-1, and one was 9-0. So sometimes, you know, we have these ideas of a closely divided court and who's going to go on which side and who's going to go on the other, but sometimes it's a little bit more complicated than that. It doesn't always work out the way you think it's going to.
What cases are of most interest to you and the Baptist Joint Committee at this point?
Some of the ones that are fascinating and at the same time difficult is the area of same-sex marriage. You know, what are some of the religious liberty issues that ramify out from that ruling last term? We're still talking about the extent to which the Affordable Care Act applies to not just churches but religiously affiliated organizations, and there's a case before the court right now dealing with that, how those religious objections, if at all, are accommodated. So, yeah, on the free exercise side, how do you have a both-and commitment to religious liberty accommodation and non-discrimination without doing violence to either one? Mm-hmm. And then on the establishment side, how do we say, look, we don't want government to promote religion. We don't want a theocracy. We don't want government picking and choosing one religion over another. We don't even want government preferring religion over irreligion. Mm-hmm. We want government to stay neutral towards religion and not taking sides. So those are all fascinating and very important issues that we face now at the Baptist Joint Committee and also as a country at large.
Brent, in the cases that you named, what's the impact going to be on those cases by the sudden death of Justice Scalia?
To the extent that there would have been a 5-4 vote with him in the majority, it's going to be a tie. It's going to be 4-4. What that means is there's no precedent set that the lower court's decision will stand as it was rendered, and then we'll go forward. So it could have a very significant impact on many of these cases and others as well. Mm-hmm. There's some talk about we ought to put it off till next year till the new president comes in. Well, if you do that, you're talking about a new justice a year or more away, and we don't need 8 justices, we need 9. Mm-hmm. And so it could be quite significant.
When you think about all that's going on politically and in the judiciary, what causes you the most concern related to the mission and work of the Joint Committee?
I think it's our inability to air our differences with civility. The acrimonious debate that we see, you know, not only in the church-state field, but in politics, it just concerns me so much that we're battling each other as enemies rather than friends and countrymen disagreeing over issues. I mean, there's no better example of that than Justice Scalia himself. As much as he liked to take the gloves off and fight when it came to issues, you know, he was pals with his adversaries. He and Justice Ginsburg had this wonderful long friendship, and Justice Kagan, many of whom he disagreed with on the issues, but he was able to treat them as friends and colleagues and draw those lines. I think that worries me as much as anything, Welton. I think we'll hold our own on how we understand the protections for religious freedom. Mm-hmm. It'll come and go and wax and wane, but I really feel a burden for trying to do our democracy mm-hmm. in a more civil way.
Brent, you know well that over more decades than I want to count, I have been devoted to the work of the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. It's always been a high priority. It's one of the central agencies in Baptist life. I'd like for you, just briefly, to tell our listeners what the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty does and how they can follow your work.
The Baptist Joint Committee serves 15 different Baptist bodies on matters relating to religious liberty and the separation of church and state. And we do that in the Supreme Court by filing briefs there, do it by working in Congress, the administration, a variety of education projects, not just for Baptists, coming out of a Baptist tradition, but for religious liberty across the board, for everyone's rights. Heading into our 80th year now and been doing it for a long time, and like to think that we've been successful at it. We would welcome anyone's support that wanted to come and join us. You can get on the website, bjconline.org. We have a wonderful blog there that one can access and learn more about current issues. So in your prayers, in your words of encouragement, even in your financial contributions, so we would enjoy the support of all of those who like what we do.
Dr. Brent Walker is Executive Director of the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. He's both a member of the Supreme Court Bar and an ordained minister. And I am grateful that we were able to draw on his expertise at this important moment in our nation's history. Brent, I thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Welton, it's been my pleasure.
Dr. J. Michelson wears two hats. On the one hand, he's a rabbi, meditation teacher, and leading writer on contemporary spirituality. On the other, Jay is a columnist for The Daily Beast, where he leads that news site's Supreme Court coverage, as well as a longtime LGBT activist and leading expert of the religious exemptions movement. He brings those two perspectives together in both sides of his work. So, Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Back in 2013, you wrote about what Justice Scalia still doesn't get about marriage. What was it like to sit in that courtroom during arguments that were so relevant to you personally?
Well, you know, it really was remarkable. I was just getting sworn into the Supreme Court bar, and we knew how eight of the justices were going to go. It was really just a question of Justice Kennedy. It was really interesting to stand up as a member of the LGBT Bar Association, and even Justice Thomas raised his head and paid attention at that moment. What that piece was about, too, for me in 2013 wasn't so much what Justice Scalia's position was, but it was the tone and the contempt that he had for, you know, something that really affects millions of Americans. And he just treated it as another opportunity to make fun of stuff.
How difficult was that for you to sit there and listen to that?
The Scalia dissent is like a work of art at this point. And I think it'll be studied for hundreds of years if our country lasts that long as a certain kind of style. And so it's not that surprising to see it when it comes up, because it comes up all the time. And, you know, for every one time he used contemptuous language to talk about LGBT people, there were a dozen times where he used that language to talk about women and reproductive justice. It wasn't super surprising. It was more, wow, this guy really doesn't get it. He just doesn't get what kind of moment this is.
Mm-hmm. Some of our listeners, Jay, may have not remembered what the Scalia dissent was, and I wish you would tell them what that is.
You know, he really pioneered a different kind of Supreme Court writing, for better or for worse, I think for worse. Dissents could often be, over the lifetime of the Supreme Court, quite vigorous. You know, people, these are very important issues, and people think the other side's gotten it wrong, and they've lost. And so you would see a lot of strong language, but it would always be a kind of elevated language. You know, my esteemed colleagues fail to realize something like that. Not always, but almost always. And, you know, Justice Scalia treated these dissents like a playground fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a more eloquent version of Donald Trump's political speeches, where you can't believe he just said that. Sometimes it's fun to read in a certain way because he's lost, and he knows he's lost, and so he's going to go down swinging. And I think that's fine in some cases. But when it came to the marriage decision, to call the reasoning that millions of people have and are thinking about how they understand the Constitution of the United States, to call that argle-bargle like he did in 2013, yeah, that's beyond disrespectful. Yeah. That's sort of missing the morality, the moral weight of the moment.
Yeah. Is that what caused so strong feelings on both sides of the political aisle when we talked about Scalia?
More than the style, it really actually was the substance of his views. So I think that, you know, his second major contribution was he really moved not just the court, but all of American jurisprudence way to the right in a way that we have never seen, really, in the history of the court. Ideas that were just outlandish a generation ago are now in the mainstream, and he, more than anyone, is responsible for that. You know, the idea that the Constitution, which itself describes how it's to be interpreted and how it's meant to grow, is meant to, you know, freeze in time what happened in 1789, or, you know, when the Due Process Clause was passed in the 1860s. You know, I mean, he really, in another gay marriage case, went to look and say, well, here's what things were in 1860, and so since there was no gay marriage then, there should be none now. I mean, that's a bizarre idea, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that would allow for segregation. That would allow for all kinds of things which we think are beyond the pale and hopefully are. But now that's really in the mainstream. And I think for those on the right who were desperately trying to hold back just the tide of change in the country over 100 years, you know, this was a way to do it. It was a way to literally turn back the clock and say, if there was no right 150 years ago or 200 years ago, then there's no right now. And that's a very powerful argument that now, again, is right in the mainstream.
The political right was remarkably organized in demanding presidential inaction on the nomination of a new Supreme Court justice. Did that surprise you?
You and I have been around the block a lot, and I think it takes a lot to surprise us. And yet, I have to admit, I was surprised. It's so unprecedented and so unheard of, and it's blatantly unconstitutional. The Constitution says right there the president shall appoint Supreme Court justices. And as President Obama said in the press conference, it's kind of ironic that people who say they're originalists are now reading in this whole new idea that in the last year you shouldn't do it, even though it just says you should. It says shall. It doesn't say shall except for when we don't want to. Obviously, as the president also noted, you know, this is a high-stakes moment, and everybody knows it, and there's no point trying to pretend as though it's not. Scalia was not a swing vote. He was really the intellectual leader of the conservative wing of the court. You know, if he's replaced with an actual liberal, which I think is unlikely, but if he is, that affects a number of cases, even in the current docket, let alone in the years to come.
We're hearing a lot about the Thurman rule. Talk about that and why you say it's not relevant here, if indeed it has any relevance at all.
So some of the Senate Republicans are saying that there's a rule. We don't do these kind of appointments in an election year. Almost everything about that statement is false. It's not a rule. It's a custom. It became known as the Thurmond Rule after Senator Strom Thurmond, the former segregationist. In 1968, he wanted to stop a Supreme Court nomination of Abe Fortas, who was a somewhat liberal associate of LBJ. Mm-hmm. So it was political when it started. It turned into a scandal. He did succeed in stopping that nomination, but it was never a rule. Also, when it was applied, when this custom was applied, it was only in the last few months of the year when the country's attention is focused on the presidential election. I mean, the earliest it was ever used was August, July and August. It was never used in the first half of the year for good reason. Even the longest, most contentious Supreme Court nomination battle took about 3 months, and that's the worst-case scenario so far. So there is this claim that we have this long-standing custom, but it's not long-standing, it's not a rule, and it's never been applied in the way that it's being applied now. And on the contrary, Reagan made his final appointment to the Supreme Court in the last year of his presidency.
Yeah. We're hearing a lot of cries of hypocrisy by people accusing Democrats of having, quote, done the same thing in the past. Isn't that wrong?
Well, you know, it's right and it's wrong. There is hypocrisy on all sides. And if you look at the data, as I did in a Daily Beast piece this week, you will find slowdowns of confirmations in the final years of all presidencies, Democrat and Republican. So all sides are playing this game. But 2 points. You know, first, the numbers of the slowdowns are completely different. We have never seen anything like what we see right now. Mm-hmm. The level of slowdown, even in 2015, it was unprecedented, and now in 2016, even worse. You know, and the second point, which, again, the president kind of mentioned, you know, it's one thing to say, to oppose, to slow down, to take various actions. At the end of the day, you do your job. And, you know, to say, well, Chuck Schumer said something one time, yeah, I mean, he said something, but nothing actually happened. And likewise with Justice Alito, as the president pointed out, you know, he's on the bench. And, you know, it's interesting because this is your show. It's an interesting moment to think about the morality of what it is to serve in public office. Mm-hmm. You know, we should understand this is a big deal. This one appointment will make a difference for decades.
Yeah.
We understand it's a big deal, but, you know, when you take an oath of office to uphold the Constitution and there's a responsibility in there, you know, you got to wonder about the moral hypocrisy, even more than the political hypocrisy of people who have taken an oath and are now breaking it.
What's the worst case scenario here?
Depending on who you ask, I think from a nonpartisan point of view, just caring about American democracy, the worst case scenario is a stalemate where nothing happens. We have never had a vacancy on a Supreme Court that's lasted, you know, a year or more, and that's what would take place if we don't get a nomination. I think the legitimacy of the Supreme Court as an institution is harmed when it's this nakedly political. And, you know, whoever wins the election and however it goes, we're going to have divided government of one sort or another, on and off for generations. That's how it works.
Yeah.
And the idea that because we fundamentally disagree on some of these key issues, we can't do our jobs, that our jobs just reduce to having these opinions, that I think is actually the worst case scenario. For some progressives, they're concerned that President Obama might nominate a moderate somebody who's not as liberal as they'd like to see. Personally, I don't see that as such a worst-case scenario. I think compromise is also part of government. It's part of working together. So for me, the worst-case scenario is just stalemate. And the confidence that's already low in our institutions goes even lower.
We've got a lot of people running for the highest office in the land who have counseled American citizens not to obey the court, not to respect the court on several different rulings, and to boast that if they're going to be in the White House, they won't abide by those rulings.
Yeah, it is really shocking. You know, I'm not an apocalyptic kind of thinker. I tend to think things are going to be basically okay. But it is really disturbing to see people running for the head of the executive branch saying, well, I'm just not going to listen to the judiciary. I mean, that's, you know, that is treason, and it's violating the rule of law. Another irony of this whole mess is there's a story that a reporter has told. It's not verified except for that one reporter, but it's an interesting story that, you know, Justice Scalia told David Axelrod, who was an Obama advisor, I know you're not going to send us a conservative. You're not going to send me someone like me, but send us someone smart. And David Axelrod said that he even said, you know, send us Elena Kagan, who ended up becoming a justice. To me, I'm not obviously a fan of Justice Scalia, but that does say something about him and about what the rule of law really means. You know, he's realistic. He understands this is a liberal administration, more or less, and they're not going to nominate a conservative. But his hope was they would nominate someone smart, competent, you know, qualified. And that's what we should always hope. And that was how, certainly, I remember, you know, when Justice Alito was nominated by President Bush, extremely conservative guy. They called him Scalito for Justice Scalia, Scalia, you know, Jr.
Yes.
But you couldn't argue with his qualifications. You know, he was a supremely qualified, very conservative figure. And that's how the rule of law is meant to work.
Dr. J. Michelson is a rabbi and a teacher, an activist and an author, an attorney and an articulate commentator. Jay's Daily Beast article is headlined, GOP Cynicism on the Supreme Court Reaches a New Low. Thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Elton. Always a pleasure.
Since retiring as the Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey in 2000, the Right Reverend John Shelby Spong has kept up a busy schedule of travel, public speaking, and prolific writing. The release of Biblical Literalism, A Gentile Heresy, marks his 25th book, and I'm delighted to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio. Bishop Spong, thanks for being with us again.
It's a pleasure to be with you again. Thank you for having me.
You know what? The last time that you and I were talking, you were mentioning that you may have written your last book.
Yeah, I've written seven last books by now.
Well, just keep it up, because when we spoke last, you were delving into the Gospels, and now it seems that you're re-entering a more contentious area of theology again, and doing it with some very strong words indeed.
What I want to do is to reclaim the power of the Bible for a non-religious age. Mm-hmm. I see my own children, my grandchildren, generations of people who are not anti-Christian, but they're anti the message they're hearing from the church because it doesn't communicate to them. They live in a world that's on the other side of Galileo and Copernicus, on the other side of Charles Darwin, on the other side of Albert Einstein, and on the other side of Stephen Hawking. They listen to the voices of the secular society today, the Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, and they don't see a way that their Sunday school faith can live in this world. And what I want to do is to sort of remove the literalistic, fundamentalistic misunderstanding of Scripture and get back to the core of the Bible's message about the sacredness of life and invite them to look at the Christian story from a different perspective just one more time. Mm. The fundamentalists constantly see me as attacking them. They are not my audience. I don't care about attacking fundamentalists. What I care about is opening up to the post-Christian generation the possibility that they can find meaning in the faith of their fathers and mothers. And I don't think they'll ever find it, there as long as it's presented to them as a pre-modern, literalistic, fundamentalistic story that you've got to believe in some literal fashion.
Biblical literalism you call a heresy, a Gentile heresy.
Yep.
Are you using heresy in the classic term? Or tell me what you mean by it.
I think I am. Christianity was born as a movement within Judaism. It was part of the synagogue until about the year 88 of this common era. Both Matthew and Mark, both of those Gospels were written while the Christian movement was still part of the synagogue. And what I'm trying to do is to get people to go back and look at those Gospels with Jewish eyes, the way they were written by Jewish Christian authors to Jewish Christian audiences, and to see if they don't see different things in there than what we see today. But by the year 150 of this common era, there were no more Jews in the Christian community that would become a totally Gentile movement. This means that from about 150 until the latter years of the 20th century, the only people that were reading the Gospels, writing commentaries on the Gospels, teaching the Gospels, were Gentiles who had no background in the Jewish scriptures, no appreciation for the way Jews told stories, no appreciation for what the Jews call midrash, the ability to wrap a story from a hero yesterday around a person living today to indicate it is the same God you see in both of these people. And so they didn't know how to read these stories with Jewish eyes. They didn't know, for example, that the feeding of the 5,000 is not a miracle about Jesus expanding the food supply. It's Jesus being wrapped inside a Moses story. Moses, who fed the children of Israel with heavenly bread in the wilderness during the book of Exodus. That's a very different way to read the story. And so the Gentiles, not knowing that kind of background, began to read all of these stories as literal stories. They don't realize such things as the virgin birth did not come into the Christian tradition until the ninth decade. You cannot find any hint of the virgin birth in Paul or in Mark. And Paul wrote from 51 to 64, and Mark wrote in the early years of the eighth decade. The virgin birth is introduced into the Christian tradition in the middle of the ninth decade. It's introduced by Matthew. And he introduces it in a way that Jews would understand that he was not intending this to be biology. Then the virgin birth is told again in Luke in a very different version. And then it disappears in John's gospel, the fourth gospel. There is no virgin birth. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is called on two occasions the son of Joseph.
Yeah, yeah. Was there ever a literal interpretation of Hebrew scriptures among the Hebrews themselves?
Well, you certainly find that in some of the Orthodox people today, but whether you'd find that in the ancient tradition when the scriptures are being written, the Middle Eastern people were storytellers. They weren't literal historians. When they told a story, the way they suggested that you not read it literally was great exaggeration. And you'd hear these great exaggerations, and that would tell you that this was a story. So they would write stories about a great big fish so big it could swallow up the prophet Jonah and swim around in the Mediterranean for 3 days and three nights. And everybody in the Jewish world would know that that was an exaggerated story, which is not to be taken literally.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that in the Hebrew tradition, there was this storytelling tradition that Western people simply do not understand and that we tend to be literal. We have our stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody said, once upon a time there was a little girl who had on a red cape and she went to visit her grandmother and her grandmother told her that she had to stay on the straight and narrow path or else the wolf would eat her, we would know that was a story. We would know that wolves aren't around eating grandmothers. But that's because we begin by once upon a time. And when Little Red Riding Hood finally gets rescued from the wolf who has eaten her, everybody knew that was a story.
Mm-hmm.
Let me look at the two most best-known miracle stories in John's Gospel, where Jesus turns water into wine at a wedding feast in Cana of Galilee, and where he raises a 4 days dead and buried Lazarus in a tomb. I don't think for a moment that the fourth gospel thought either of those was literal.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the gospel story in John about the water into wine, you discover that it's filled with exaggerations. Jesus doesn't just turn water into wine so that wedding feast can go on. He turns it into 900 bottles of wine. That'll keep a wedding party going for a very long time. And Jesus doesn't just raise Lazarus from the dead. He raises him from the dead when he's been buried for 4 days and his flesh has already begun to smell. And the reason you know that is that Martha, Lazarus' sister in this story, says, "Oh, Lord, please don't open that cave. It's the fourth day and there will be an odor." Mm-hmm. So these are exaggerated stories. Now, if you can convince me that a story that happened literally around the year 30 of this common era, where in a very public setting, a man is called out of the death of a tomb where his body is wrapped in burial cloths and the flesh has already begun to decay, and he walks out of that tomb alive, and nobody's going to write about that story for 65 years until John puts it in his gospel. That's the only place it occurs. That's just simply not believable. It's clear to me that they did not intend those stories to be taken literally. And then you've got to go back and say, well, what then do those stories mean? In the water into wine story, the water that's used is the water set aside for Jewish rites of purification. The wine is a symbol of the Christian Eucharist. John is talking about the transition from Judaism into Christianity, and we need to go back and capture the original meaning of that story and stop pretending that Jesus liked wedding parties so much that when the wine ran out, he did a miracle and produced 900 bottles of wine so they could keep celebrating for a few days. Where I grew up in the South, if anybody had put that much wine into a story about Jesus, they probably would have been forced out of the ministry.
I want you to talk about the cost of literalism, the spiritual cost, the faith cost. In other words, describe the damage that you see being done, not just to religion, but to faith through the approach.
See, I grew up as a fundamentalist in an evangelical Episcopal church in Charlotte, North Carolina. And that church taught me that segregation was the will of God, that men were superior to women by creation, that it was okay to hate other religions, and especially the Jews, and that homosexuals were either mentally sick or morally depraved. And I had to work out from under every one of those because they quoted the Bible to prove that all of those are correct. What literalism has done, let me talk about its good side, because it has a good side. I was a child of an alcoholic father who died at age 12. My family was really insecure. The security of believing that there was a literal father in heaven who took me by the hand and took care of me probably gave me the strength to persevere in my rather dysfunctional family. I think literalism gives people security, and it's a false security, which is the trouble. Christianity does not call us to be secure. It doesn't provide us for being secure. And we know that because even the most pious and religious families still suffer through tragedy, and their children still get killed in war, and they have babies that are born deceased or deformed. There's no correlation between the depth of your faith and the reality of your life. So we look for security, but it's always a false security. And a false security will never get you through life. What the Christian faith gives me is not security. It gives me the courage to walk into the future, into the unknown, with integrity, despite the fact that there's no security. I think that's the thing that the Christian faith is all about. It does not solve my problems. It gives me the courage to deal with my problems. It gives me the ability to live in a world where there's a lot of pain and suffering, and not to lose my faith or my understanding of God. That's a very big difference from pretending that if you believe hard enough, everything's going to work out just fine. Never works that way.
How does a person move from the kind of literalistic orientation that you had, that I had? I am making the assumption that changes occurred in us because we wanted to learn. When we saw more truth, we tried to embrace more truth and keep learning and keep growing.
Sometimes the security needs of people is far deeper than their need for truth. And, you know, you see that happening politically in our nation today. People are so afraid that the world is changing and that black people might be elected president or a woman might be elected president, that this is incredible anger that's out there. And in the situation with Justice Scalia and his appointment, he is the primary conservative vote in a 5-4 conservative majority. Mm-hmm. If that shifts from a 5-4 liberal majority, there are people that think that the world is just going to collapse. And so there's enormous fear. And so you want to keep it like it used to be. The only trouble with that is if you live in time, there's no such thing as keeping it like it used to be. Mm-hmm. Christian faith calls us to step into the unknown, to step into tomorrow. And you and I are being forced to live in a modern world, and if the Christian faith can't speak to that modern world, there's not going to be a Christian future. That's where my concern is, and that's where I try to bring my own children and my own grandchildren into another view of the Christian faith that can live with integrity inside the 21st century and can compel not just their hearts, but their minds to walk in the Christ path.
Mm. The Right Reverend John Shelby Spong is the retired bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Newark, New Jersey, a leading progressive theologian. He is a much-in-demand public speaker, you understand why, and a prolific writer whose latest book is titled Biblical Literalism, a Gentile Heresy. Bishop Spong, thank you so much
for
being.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and I guess I'll have to write another book or not get another interview with you. So,
I think we can work out that, whether you do or not, because I love talking with you. Thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
A pleasure.
Now, before we go, I want to share a reflection or two on observations I've made over the past week. I don't think I've ever dabbled in Christian theology on this show, and for good reasons. However, I want to make an exception to that today. In Christian theology, there is a concept called the unpardonable sin, a wrong so terrible that it's unforgettable and unforgivable. Personally, I always have leaned toward a different interpretation of this doctrine of an unpardonable sin. Not identifying it as a specific act or belief, rather understanding it as the description of a troubling situation, a mindset out of touch with truth and reality. For me, the concept of an unforgivable sin is related directly to a situation in which people have completely lost their way, sold out to insanity, lost touch with wisdom completely, skewed values dramatically, and scrambled priorities dangerously. In other words, a sin is unforgivable because no one can even identify the difference between good and evil. Right looks like wrong, and wrong is lauded as right. Now, my purpose in sharing this thought is not about a theology lesson. Rather, it is related to frightening realities that I see in our nation, both in the wake of the death of Antonin Scalia and in the rhetoric that is pervading so much of the presidential primaries. I have a notion that we are living in a crazy time, when the world as we have known it seems to have turned upside down. A nation of immigrants has, in large part, gone completely negative on American hospitality and compassionate immigration. Leaders seeking the highest office in our land have posted a "keep out" sign over the words of our Statue of Liberty that read, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free." So are we the America we have been, or have we lost sight of the meaning of America? Have we lost our way and will? Are we living in an upside-down world? Our nation's greatest gift to the world has been identified as the concept of religious freedom. Every individual's freedom to believe or not to believe, and to practice religion or to reject religion without negative political consequences. Now, would-be defenders of the U.S. Constitution are campaigning on promises to oppose religious freedom and see to it that unaccepted religions, by their definition, be banned from this nation. With stunning insensitivity to the death of a great patriot of our nation, congressional leaders stepped on the grief of those mourning the loss of the Supreme Court justice to declare their partisan intention to prohibit the sitting president of the United States from doing his constitutional duty and nominating a new justice for the high court, and assuring their refusal to confirm any appointment recommended by the president. People are claiming to deny the constitutional process for staffing the Supreme Court using the rationale, the justification, that they are protecting the Supreme Court. Does that not sound like the irrational thinking of people living in an upside-down world? Such an argument throws me back to the absolute stupidity that we heard in Vietnam when our troops were told to destroy a village in order to save it. Nothing less is at stake here than the strength and integrity of democracy itself. It is time for us to challenge those who want to destroy freedom in order to protect freedom, to destroy religious liberty in order to protect religious liberty, and to violate the Constitution in order to save the Constitution. A sin cannot be forgiven if people see no differentiation between the highest good and the greatest evil. We will not preserve our democracy by weakening it or ignoring it altogether. Is it too much to hope that some of us will step forward to advocate that we recover the integrity of basic democratic values, to remind us that liberty, not partisanship, is the highest good in our democracy, and that nothing is more important now than stabilizing an upside-down world so that all who want to see can see the dangers in our nation, and can see the way to eradicate those dangers and take a step forward toward America becoming a little closer to what it means to be America again. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I am so thankful you have done that. I hope you know it. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long, online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussions. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.